everybody. Welcome back to You Can't Win. This is Tom here, and I'm joined by Donald as usual, as well as returning guest Professor Pizzagate. Today we're going to be going into your questions that you've been sending us regarding Epstein and Pizzagate and all this kind of fun stuff. So we're going to get through all those questions, hopefully, and then maybe do a little bit of a follow-up on some of the developments that have happened since we did our last episode on this kind of thing, and where our research interests have headed. So let's get right into it. So first question. Hey guys, love the show. I found the Epstein talk fairly informative and interesting to think about. However, I wondered if you had any thoughts on the idea that a lot of witnesses such as Rosenstiel, the gay DC madam guy, were either exaggerating for effect and to sell books or attempting to get out of a prison sentence. Thanks.
Okay, I just want to say about the DC madam. If you read that book, it's not very sensational. And if anything, he's maybe playing down a little bit how much he knew about what was going on. I mean, it reads to me like a book that is carefully written to disclose something that is this guy is very uncomfortable with and he views as being still potentially dangerous to him. So I don't think that's like a monetary ploy. And it's like the press, the print is like Trine Press or something, like Trine Day Press. Like it's some tiny little conspiracy publisher, right? Like they're not making money on this.
Right. That being said, that is their market, right? If it's a conspiracy press.
It's true. But I really think that's more of like a labor of love for those guys. Like I don't think that they're very profitable. Like I think they're getting this stuff out there because they think it's important and not because it's lucrative.
Yeah. And as far as Rosenstiel, his wife goes, that was a testimony to a New York, either to the police or in the court. I forget exactly where that came out. I'd have to go back and check. But I mean, if a New York judge is willing to accept that, I'm willing to accept it. You know, like at that point, I think that's fairly strongly corroborated by a lot of the other things that you can point to as well. So you got to take it in context of like, that being said, like it's a good instinct to be wary of people making sensationalist claims and not going just on the basis of one source saying one thing. The guy that wrote the DC Madam, he's Vincent, right? Something Vincent?
Henry Vincent.
Ed Opperman did an interview with him that I have been meaning to get around to. So he is alive. So
yeah.
Usually if someone gets murdered for printing this kind of stuff, that's a pretty good sign that somebody cared about it for some reason,
He actually still has his funeral. Like the guy is like a trained funeral parlor director. Mm. And he's back at that after his prison stint. So he's still around. And it actually seems to be the case that, most of the people who like were associated with Nick Bryant and spoke to Nick Bryant, like they all seem to kind of have this idea that going fully public, like you're not going to get this information out into the mainstream, but this is somehow protective, like having your story fully documented and out there in some way prevents them from coming after you as hard as they otherwise could. I'm not entirely sure how that works, to be honest.
I don't buy that because that's what, what's his name? One of the kids that was tied up in this that was talking to the Conspiracy of Silence filmmaker, Tim something. Anyway, he was convinced to get his story out there about how he was abused and used as a sex slave for all this kind of thing. And he was killed for it. And the idea was like, well, if you get your story out there, you'll be protected. Well, that didn't end up being the case.
Yeah.
So I don't buy that. And I think a lot of times, like you and I, Mike, recently found, that one website with,
Was that Fiona Barnett?
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah, Fiona. Yeah.
Fiona Barnett. Yeah, and Opperman actually had her on apparently as well a bunch.
Yeah, and he wasn't buying it either.
No, I guess. He was. He said that, like, the stuff about Kidman's dad, he was kind of, like, persuaded by her. He thought that something was there. And then she kind of, like, changed over time and started saying all this stuff about how she was, like, a CIA super soldier and stuff like that. I mean, this is, like, part of the problem, right? And I think we've spoken about this before. Like, many of these people, they may legitimately be victimized and also be saying things that are not true, right? And in part because they're victimized. So.
Yeah, like they might be psychologically messed up, and that might be purposeful. Like they might actually like damage these people to the point of like, well, if they're going to squeal, they're just going to say a bunch of dumb stuff that no one can take seriously. So
one of the things that I was interested about or interested in that Colin Ross said, and Colin Ross is a guy who has been doing a lot of work. He's a psychiatrist, Canadian guy who now works in Texas, and he's doing a lot of work on dissociative identity disorder. And
he's the big guy on that, isn't he?
He's one of the major kind of names, and he's a really smart guy, and I think he's been a very good proponent of a sort of realistic empirical look at this phenomenon. But one of the things that he mentions is that, you know, like the satanic ritual abuse people and the alien abduction people report a lot of the same stuff, like in terms of the sort of like phenomenological components of their experience, the missing time, the like weird kind of like, you know, experiences of being on a table or some kind of inside a circle of people standing around you and like all of the strange stuff. Those groups of patients, according to him, will not have anything to do with each other. Like, no, like the satanic ritual abuse people are like, no, the alien people are crazy. And the alien people are like, no, the satanic ritual abuse people are crazy. So it's very interesting, like, to consider the possibility that maybe these are like related phenomena in some way. But it's been really effective if these are like actually, and I think, you know, Ross, he doesn't make this explicit, but I think he thinks that some of this is coming out of like whatever these military intelligence psychiatric programs are. And if that's the case, then this stuff is really effective at discrediting the victims, right? Because the victims are not even able to identify each other, if that's true. Right?
Yeah, for sure. I've actually heard a lot of very negative things about Colin Ross. I'm surprised to hear you talking about him as like a, you know, you consider him reputable.
On certain topics, and I mean, look, psychiatry, as far as I'm concerned, is mostly nonsense, right? Like it's not a particularly reliable field to begin with. But I think that DID is real, and I think that dissociative disorders are not given or are given short shrift for reasons that are like very unclear to me. And you know, one of the things that Ross points out is that you know, the psychiatric story on schizophrenia is in many ways much weaker than the psychiatric story on DID. So why is schizophrenia like universally accepted and DID is this kind of like controversial, like fringe, can't be a real disorder, you know, we don't know what the biological basis is for this is, et cetera, et cetera. Like there are all these kinds of deflections around it. And
just to interrupt there. So when you say the story is less established or something like that for schizophrenia, what do you mean exactly? Just from my own experience, I mean, you know, I've talked about it pretty openly before, is that I went to early psychosis like intervention clinic for a few years when I was in Montreal, and one of the doctors there was very, very insistent really on saying that actual specific diagnosis doesn't matter much, and that I shouldn't really put much stock into it because things like schizophrenia and psychosis will eventually be just on a spectrum kind of thing. And it will be not seen as a specific disorder, but more kind of like a range of disorders or something like that. So is that closer to what you're saying? Or is it you just saying that it's not even really... Yeah, I'm trying to understand because... So I know that in the early 90s, there was kind of stuff around multiple personalities becoming like almost like a fad or something, like a wave of people coming out saying that they had it. And they kind of related that back to the think like things on television or something. And then it got within the mainstream of the profession, it kind of was discredited after a few years and then just kind of disappeared, it seemed like, as a diagnosis. So are you like, how does that jive those kind of 2 points, like with this kind of
research? Yeah, okay. We probably don't want to get too far afield here, but there's a lot to talk about with medical psychiatry and in relation to this stuff. I mean, just narrowly on the point of schizophrenia, the classical story about schizophrenia being, you know, a genetic disease primarily, right, related to dopamine signaling, is more or less a post hoc justificatory story to explain the efficacy of dopamine receptor ligands in treating people who have these symptoms, right? So someone comes into the ER and they're hearing voices and you give them one of these drugs, it works. And so the biological explanation, the medical psychiatric explanation for this was, okay, well, these people have, you know, problems with dopamine signaling. And, you know, this is going to be ultimately explained at that level, right? At the level of receptor pharmacology, because the level of receptor pharmacology is where we're acting in order to treat this disease. So if that's the case, then, you know, the story went, okay, we should find all of these underlying genetic causes, right? So we should find particular genetic loci which are statistically associated with the occurrence of schizophrenia. And, you know, we can do this at a very large scale in quite significant populations now. And the best attempts to find genetic components for schizophrenic outcomes have found that something like 2 or 3% of the variability in schizophrenic outcomes is accounted for by these genetic factors, right? So
wow.
It's small. Like the contribution at that level is quite small. So it's, I mean, the conventional medical psychiatric story about schizophrenia, I'm not saying it's wrong, it's just not the whole story, right? And sure. It's well accepted. You know, the stuff about, like, for instance, there are a number of people who talk about this. I mean, another guy who's become popular recently is, you know, Aaron Mate's dad, is Gabor Mate. He's another Canadian psychiatrist, actually. But Aaron Mate's been, like, kind of interviewing his dad a lot on, like, Real News and other places. And he's been getting quite a bit of play. And one of the interesting things that he has to say is about trauma, right? Like that the relationship between trauma and particularly childhood trauma and later, you know, mental health problems is much stronger than, you know, the evidence for some kind of like underlying biological thing where it's just like a certain fraction of the people go crazy for no reason, right? And I think a lot of this is because trauma is sort of a mechanism in our society that is too important to address directly and honestly, because if people knew how it worked, then it wouldn't work. But that's kind of, I don't even remember what the question is anymore.
So, sorry, but I mean that, like, you know, we talked about, you know, you started bringing up DID. And I was thinking how that related to kind of the craze in the
90s. So So MPD or multiple personality disorder is now called DID or dissociative identity disorder. And I think in part because like this multiple personality thing is discredited in a lot of ways, right? And a lot of the, you know, psychiatry is the Wild West, man. Like when people are getting patients and they're seeing these things, you know, in the wild, they're coming up with all kinds of weird concepts and constructs to try to explain what's going on. My feeling anyway is that there is a dissociative component to trauma where people are able to compartmentalize, they're able to deal with trauma by compartmentalizing it.
Mm-hmm.
And in cases of very severe trauma, you get really extensive compartmentalization. For some people. And this kind of ties into the MKUltra programs and what they were all up to. We probably don't want to get too far into that, but I do believe that there is a dissociative component to trauma reactions. I think you can see that in PTSD, and you can see it in other kinds of trauma disorders. And I think that it might be related also to some dissociative drug phenomena, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's all interesting to me.
I could buy that. The thing about Colin A. Ross that I've read about him that really makes me, it's just very strange. There's something going on with him and the Satanic Church, which sounds very weird, except that when you consider that Colin A. Ross deals with a lot of people who claim satanic ritual abuse, of course, the Church of Satan will want to be like, no, that's nonsense. We don't do that kind of stuff. And that might be true. Like, I generally don't think the actual, like, Satanic Church is really anything but a kind of, like, goofy little thing. But... they were making some
libertarians. Like, I think it's a libertarian
club. Yeah. I mean, it's very benign, right? Like, as far as I can tell. But what they were claiming about Ross was that there's this woman, Roma Hart, who litigated against him actually and claimed that basically any patient that came to him, he would very aggressively diagnose them with DID and also claim that, well, everyone who has DID has that because they were molested by their parents as children, and so would start to, again, aggressively try to, like, convince the patient that this was the case, put them on extreme doses of drugs to the point where they would be, like, just completely out of it. This woman claimed that she was having seizures from the heavy doses of medication she was on, and that people would be at a certain point that Ross would take them and have them stay at his clinic or whatever, and that they would just be in this, like, cell with a mattress, and that, you know, it gets pretty.
So he's doing the MK Ultra stuff.
That's essentially what it seems like is happening there with those claims. And there's a very weird connection to Colin A. Ross that's come up lately with the shooter who was, I think Dayton was the one who was connected to, like, the left Twitter guys, right?
Yeah.
He was the one that was following all those people. Right. His father is a psychiatrist that worked at a hospital in Texas, I think, called Timberlawn. And this guy, this shooter's father, he was into the John of God cult. He was really into those, like, healing crystal type stuff. And that hospital that he was working at, Timberlawn, got shut down because they were getting a large amount of complaints about abuses going on, and there was some rapes that happened there that seemed to be completely, like, just negligence, or, like, almost like willfully allowing it to happen kind of a thing, where they would just have, like, a violent, aggressive person in the same room as, like, a teenage girl, and just kind of, like, knowing that essentially what they were doing and stuff. Very weird stuff. And I mean, I'm not saying that even has anything to do with the shooting. It might be that having, like, this kind of weirdo father will kind of mess you up and maybe you end up being a shooter. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's any direct connection there or something, but
yeah, that's all news to me. I don't know anything about that. I mean, my attitude is trust a clinician, right? Like, if they have an MD after their name, then whatever, but I'm being a little bit facetious. I mean, I don't take what he's saying at face value. I mean, I spent quite a long time studying, you know, basically, like, medical psychiatry, from the pharmacology side, and I believe that he at least is, you know, onto something with the DID story. If he's going out and kind of, like, diagnosing everyone with DID, I mean, yeah, like, that happens, right? You know, if you all you have is a hammer, right? Everything looks like a nail. But
I mean, Freud did that sort of stuff too. You know, what I mean? It's one of those things where I'm not trying to, like, say, like, that. I'm not trying to discredit him necessarily. I just don't know. I was just surprised because you seem to have taken, from what you've read, you've encountered kind of more like of a positive interpretation of it. And what I've kind of come across has been the opposite. So I wonder what that's about. You know what I mean? That's all I'm trying to say.
What I would suggest is, like, for people who are interested in this, I mean, Colin Ross has a book called The CIA Doctors. It's not really, like, a good read, but it's sort of like a collection of his notes about this MKUltra CIA kind of network's infiltration into medical psychiatry and the complicity of psychiatrists with this network and this these kinds of practices. My impression from reading the book was that he was really, really concerned about medical ethics. And, you know, most of the chapters kind of conclude with, you know, no psychiatric professional associations have repudiated any of these practices or denounced, like, you know, their complicity in MKUltra, much less, you know, more recent things like the interrogation programs, right? So my impression of him was positive because I felt he was concerned with the ethical side of things more than just kind of like trying to sell books about, you know, titillating subjects while engaging in his own little, you know, like MKUltra sexual fantasies. I don't know, right? But if people
I don't know either.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say is that book, the CIA Doctors, is a good compilation of sources about this kind of stuff. So if you're looking for kind of an end to, you know, what papers should I read? Because these guys were, you know, the CIA Doctors, the guys who were working on this stuff, were publishing openly about what they were doing well into the 70s. So, you know, if you want kind of like the bibliography, then I would recommend looking at that. But yeah, take everything with a grain of salt, right?
That's basically the takeaway here. I think is anytime you kind of run into this sort of stuff, you will quickly find that there's conflicting narratives and everyone seems to have their own interests. And you very quickly get into like iffy territory.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go on to the second question. I'd like everyone's, including Leo's, take on whether it's ultimately perverted or dead-ended to pay too much attention to the Epstein sex scandal stuff. Thanks, you guys are great. So we'll have to ask Leo about all this stuff next time we have him on. But I tend to think that, I wouldn't say perverted. I mean, I guess it depends on what sort of stuff you're trying to find and what's really grabbing your attention. But dead-ended, I certainly think so. Like, I think this is one of those things that you will just run to a certain point where you're not really getting reliable information. You're not going to be able to connect all the dots. And at that point, it's just kind of like, yeah, it's not going to go anywhere. And you just have to kind of accept that you're not really ever going to be able to get real concrete evidence of anything. You're not going to really know what happened. It's kind of like looking into JFK assassination or something. It's just kind of like the only people who really know what happened are the people who were involved, and maybe not even that, you know, maybe not even them.
Yeah. You know, I think I kind of have to watch myself, right, in terms of like, what is my intent in engaging with this stuff? Like, and I think as long as it's mostly kind of like, I'm trying to figure out how this works and what it means to me, and I'm kind of like proceeding from a position of basically like being super morally outraged about what appears to be going on. And it's not really about like, you know, being titillated or like, you know, making excuses for like the way things are, you know, the pedophiles control everything or whatever, right? If it's not these other kinds of peripheral things that you can get sucked into, then I think it's more justified. But like, it's a waste of time for the most part.
Yeah, we're not really going to be able to affect it, right? So,
you know, certainly not yet. I mean, I feel like we're getting closer to being able to make sense of things. But yeah, is it something you should be spending like a lot of your time doing? No, not really. I mean, I think once you get caught up, you don't really have to. I mean, you'll be able to recognize what's important in the kind of like trickle of information over the years anyways.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about like politics generally. You know, like this is sort of like, I would call this like deep state politics or parapolitics or whatever. But like, it's the same thing with regular politics. You know, you learn a little bit of theory that makes sense to you. You do a little bit of historical research. You kind of put together a narrative that makes sense. And then you don't have to follow every little news article or whatever. You can kind of tell what's going on in the world by the major events and, you know, just how things evolve.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and like, just don't get sucked into like the details of the abuse and this kind of stuff. Like I can see people getting like really disturbed by a lot of this stuff. Like it's not important. Like it's not the central. Like you were talking about that like Nixon accusation. I remember the other day.
Yeah, that was the Fiona. Yeah, she was making those.
Oh, that was her, eh? Yeah.
Yeah.
And And there's some like disturbing photos that were associated with that, or drawings allegedly that she had made. And, you know, even if they're fake, you know, you were kind of like, well, maybe you don't want to see those. It's like, yeah, I don't need to see those, right? Like, it's, yeah. There's a lot of stuff that's not necessary for anyone to investigate, I think.
Yeah, there's that one movie, America's MIA Children or whatever. And that has a bunch of, like, the intro sequence has a bunch of shots of, like, of stills from snuff films that they had found. And that, you know, is it supposed right. to be about this? But, it's just right there from the very beginning. Completely yeah. unnecessary. I mean, I understand they're trying to expose this stuff and whatever, but I don't think anyone really, I won't even describe what was there, but you don't really need to see that. I think I've been so desensitized to internet stuff, like, from a very early age, that as long as it's like on a screen, I can kind of put enough distance between myself and it that I can read this stuff. I can even see images and things, and it doesn't really bother me so much. Like, it affects me, but not to the point of where I feel like I need to really, I don't know, like, it's not deeply traumatizing me, unless it is and I just can't tell. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, let's move on to the next one. Do you think there's a connection between how all this child abuse goes on while the media freaks out over imaginary Super Bowl white slavery epidemics? I bet a lot of these trophy wives who start, quote, anti-trafficking charities, end quote, like Swanee or Swanee Hunt, have husbands who participate in child rape rings.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. That seems to be a theme. I mean, I think maybe part of my problem with some of these questions is that, like, the really outrageous stuff, I'm just kind of like, yeah, like, I think so.
Yeah.
I don't know, but at least, you know, this seems to be a common theme that many of the people in these networks are involved in charitable, Maxwell, she's like, in addition to being a submarine pilot, like, that's all linked up with her charitable work with like ocean charities, whatever it is, like reefs and stuff like that, right?
Sure.
And there's lots of these people who, I mean, I think is it like, it's just kind of part of the elite world, right? Like, that if you have a certain amount of money, there's kind of like noblesse oblige on at least an appearances level. So mm-hmm. a lot of these people will be involved with the charitable stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the, especially in the UK, I think a lot of this sort of thing happens under the auspices of like being some sort of like school thing, like private schools or,
yeah.
You know, school charities, help the children kind of thing. That seems to, or at least the most visible stuff that we can have access to seems to take place under that. There's Laura Silsby, who was operating as like a missionary / humanitarian. I think even John of God was operating like that. There's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I think once you're at the point where you're willing to like create sex slaves and traffic children and stuff for sex, I think the idea of like, oh, you know, doing it under cover of like a humanitarian organization or some kind of nice thing like that, that's pretty small beans, you know, like yeah. you're so deep into it. Like, of course you're going to do that because that just gives you access to children and all that kind of thing. So that being said, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the case that every celebrity who's doing something like that is tied up in this, you know. I think there's a lot of yeah. people that do it and they're just genuine.
Yeah, there's a definitely a danger in kind of, I mean, this is what happens to a lot of the sort of like people online that you see talking about this kind of stuff, is they see a pattern and then it just gets applied universally, right? And it's like, I can't ever look at, you know, like an adoption agency or something like this without getting angry and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's happening, but it's like a certain percent of the population, and it's, you know, it's not universal, and probably the vast majority of people who are working in these organizations, even the ones that are involved in trafficking, are probably well-intentioned and maybe even accomplishing good. Like, the people who are trafficking the kids don't care if the organization is actually doing good or not. I mean, if it is, that's probably better if they can do it cheaply, because then it's a more effective cover, right? So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, this might make some people mad, but I think it's the same thing with the police. Like, you see a lot of, you know, obviously the police force are corrupt pretty much everywhere. And there's a lot of abuses that go on. There's a lot of like you know, just huge, massive mistakes that these guys make. And then it's all covered up by the judges and the police unions and stuff. But I think there's also a lot of cops who like want to do good, like they want to be the good guy cop, you know, and sometimes they're able to do that kind of thing. So it's just, yeah, it's one of these things you don't want to start looking at things in terms of like categories and just lump them in. Yeah. These are the good guys, these are the bad guys, because they're in that category. Like, things are very complicated in the real world.
I find that something that I have to kind of think through too, because obviously with, like, say, the Catholic Church abuse scandal, you know, I mean, there is kind of a popular kind of opinion now, I think, that people attribute it some sort of unique factor in the Catholic Church that creates that tendency within the church, as sure. if it's like a Catholic thing.
Yeah.
I think that's a prevailing kind of opinion. And if that were true, obviously it would be, it has to be, I mean, for me, it has to be a combination of sociological factors. Like, it has to be things that add up to something that's extra bad. You know, there are people in the church that tend to say, well, it's statistically, if you kind of compare like with like, there's no additional problem. That's kind of like, sometimes there's that defense. That's what the church sometimes kind of leads with in a lot of things too. For me, it's more relating back to kind of what you're saying. Like, one is kind of like opportunity, number one. Like, you have to look at, say, anyone that works with children independently or something, right? Like, that has that kind of proximity to potential for abuse. Number one is kind of like, that is the first kind of filter of looking at statistics or something like that, right? And then beyond that, you kind of have to go down to stuff like expectation in the community that this type of person wouldn't do anything wrong or something, right? Like, you have to kind of think in that. And I think that, and you kind of have to go down the list. And it does make me wonder too, you know, like, you know, how do you isolate those factors and then treat them effectively, right? Like, how can you, you know, there are kind of like a tendency now online, especially with, say, sex trafficking related charities or something like that, to kind of assume that all of them are just doing police work that is negative or something, mm-hmm. right? Like, that, I think that's kind of a dominant belief outside of, say, people who are very, very anti-sex work, like, on kind of like our section of, or like my section at least, of the internet kind of thing. There's a lot of people who, if they hear anything about sex trafficking, they immediately kind of say, well, it's just overblown fake crisis or something like that, right? Like, I think that's kind of a thing, but you wouldn't necessarily want, like, anyways, the point being is that you kind of have to work down these kind of steps of percentages or something like that, right? And then figure out what factors are actually contributing and what are unique to, say, like the weak institutions in the Catholic Church that aren't effective at policing itself or anything like that. So I think that's something that I've been kind of thinking about when you guys have been talking about these kind of things. Because I don't know, I tend to respond in terms of, how do you respond at an institutional level? How do you fix these kind of things? And anyways, that's the kind of thing that I think of when we're talking about, say, you know, negative types of psychiatry or negative types of perspectives, like, you know, like these kind of sex trafficking organizations, whatever, like, how do you actually fix that without just kind of being, I don't know, fear mongering around it or something. Yeah. So anyways, I just thought I'd say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I think that happens, especially with the internet, I think this is sort of something that's new and that people haven't really adjusted yet, is that you can get you can get information about a lot of different things, but it won't necessarily be very in-depth and it won't necessarily be representative. So you might get one little fact, or one, it may not even be a true fact. It might just be, you know, you'll get some kind of information about something, and because you're so ignorant about it otherwise, because you've just been introduced to this thing, that fact will become the entire truth about that thing that you know, and then it colors the way that you interpret all other information that you receive that kind of touches on that issue.
Sure.
So I think in general, you want to be very careful about that kind of stuff and to just understand, like, what are my blind spots, or what am I ignorant of, you know, just kind of be aware that, okay, I've been told one thing, but if I'm interested in pursuing more, set that to the side for a second and then keep looking, and then start, once you have like some kind of significant amount of evidence, then you can really start to make more deductions and stuff. I think too often people will get one piece of information, two pieces of information, and then all of a sudden they think they're experts and they start making these big bombastic statements that, you know, just paint with a wide brush. And it's, you know, that you're never going to be really correct when you do that. That's just a recipe for disaster. So
sure.
If I can just add one thing, it's useful to remember that it's, you know, kind of like a spiritual injunction, at least I'm sure this is in Catholicism as well, to have a good opinion of people as your kind of like prior, right? Like until you have evidence otherwise, like just assume that someone is working in good faith and is not a pedophile, right? Like
yeah, that's a good rule of thumb, I'd say. Yeah, and there's also, you know, the hadith about it's enough for someone to repeat knowledge without confirming it to be called a liar.
Sure.
So you can be considered a liar just for not really checking your sources or confirming something you've been told. So,
but they've actually, it's funny because they have changed a lot of the practices, at least on paper, things that people aren't making those assumptions without checking or something, you know, like, so if you want to volunteer at a church now, or you want to, for any position that involves contact with parishioners or anything like that, right? You need to go through a screening process that involves like background checks, you have to put on the form, like they ask on the form different things about sexuality and specifics about sometimes about like sexual orientation and all that kind of thing, like very, very specific, a lot of it. So priests aren't supposed to be alone with children now, basically. Like there's a lot of things where volunteers aren't supposed to either. Like you're supposed to kind of have these kind of basic kind of security things. But it's funny in some ways because it does create that, at some level, it's saying that you're prone to, not prone, but like, I'm not sure what the, you know, proximate to it or something, you know, like there's some potential there in those kind of situations. So I feel like the situation has changed a lot in terms of our expectations of people, where this kind of defensive thinking, where there is kind of an expectation now almost that abuse is a fact of life and that you have to kind of create all of these filters to engage with it. So I think that's interesting because I also feel like that probably hasn't filtered out to a lot of other institutions right now. Number one, I don't know if it's even working in the church, but number two, I know that, say, teachers now are not supposed to touch children at all. I mean, not like, you know, even just kind of, they have a lot of rules now where they're supposed to kind of, at least they kind of say that sometimes, where they're not supposed to kind of, say, pat a kid on the back or something like that kind of thing. Like I've heard those kind of stories from teachers before where they say there's small kind of changes like that that are happening now where, and I don't know. I don't know if that's something that we have to kind of go through as a society and kind of create this kind of distance, you know, for a bit and kind of work out these institutions. But it would be positive to kind of internalize morality to the point where you didn't need those kind of, especially, we've talked about this before, but it becomes a huge issue when you start talking about, like, say, evidence rules and things like that, right? Where it's already at the point now where, you know, we talked about psychiatry. If you call for help or something like that, you know, or if you call for, you show up or something, upset or something, you tend to be kind of shuttled pretty quickly into, in almost in a lot of places at least, where they'll basically lock you up, basically, right? They'll put you into like mandated care in different ways, right? And right. If they consider you a threat in some way, and that can be pretty loose, you know, the definitions there. And, you know, stuff like priests are required to, you know, might be required in some places to report behaviors and stuff. So it does quickly kind of run up against the potential religious questions, especially in Catholicism, where admissions of guilt to a priest are supposed to be pretty, you're supposed to be basically saying it directly to God, right? Like you're basically, the priest is there in the presence of Jesus, basically, like, you know, and then to create an expectation that those interactions would be evidence, you know, it changes the nature of the situation again. So I think that's interesting how to negotiate that without just stonewalling, right? You don't want to just say, you don't want to not change in response to severe problems. So anyways.
Yeah. Okay. Next question on, this is a long one. So on Epstein, I think the suicide is at the very least highly suspect in terms of how it was allowed to happen. But more specifically from the left, how much of this fits into Engel's bourgeois homosexual pedophile hypothesis? There was rich and self-aware pedos, which weirdly parallels the reactionary Tradcath's take on the scandal. and Marx's bourgeois family critique that spouses seducing each other, spouses and wives, daughters of the proletariat. I don't quite understand what that was trying to get at, but I've seen dark forces at work within certain outlets publishing Pedo Apologia. The idea that the reptile-brained elite would develop insatiable sexual appetites hooked on a limitless growth myth seems plausible. And for organizing, fear and hate can unite, and people generally fear/hate pedos. It's one thing to bamboozle people with an exploitive system. It's another to be chilling on a child rape island. Can a Marxist critique be used to help frame this for the left in such a matter that you don't need fake news to elevate class consciousness? Relating this to the church and Pizza Mike's discussion on Epstein's dog-like behavior, do you think it's possible this is strategic, i.e. that Epstein is a Satan in the desert sequel tempter used to blackmail, which is probably not too outlandish? And could it be replicated like the pedo priests are moles handpicked as assets to tarnish the church's reputation using its internal hierarchies against it? Okay, that was a little all over the place, but let's kind of break this down and see what we can get out of this. So the first part of this question is that how much of this, which I assume just means the general case of what we can see from Epstein and the whole network, fits into Engels' bourgeois homosexual pedophile hypothesis and Marx's bourgeois family critique. I am not super familiar with those. I remember reading them way back and not being very impressed with either. It just seemed like a very kind of almost juvenile, crude take on trying to reduce family dynamics to some kind of materialist thing and seeing like, oh, look, I solved it and it's actually a bad thing or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't really know what Engels' homosexual pedophile bourgeois thing is. Is that just like the general stereotype that
decadence? Yeah.
Yeah. Decadence. Is that the hypothesis? Okay. What do you guys think about that? Do you think this kind of makes those ideas valid to some extent or what?
No, I don't know. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I feel like, just to continue on almost from what I was saying before, but so the person, I'm guessing it's a he, I don't know. I don't know a woman that would ask this question maybe, but like, the Tradcath connection there is that the mainstream right-wing opinion about this kind of stuff in the Catholic Church is that it's gay priests, basically. Like, it's a gay priest problem and not a child abuse problem kind of thing. That's the way that they kind of portray it. And it's because a lot of the individual cases that have got garnered media attention have tended to be officials, like clergy and stuff, molesting like teenage boys. So they've kind of created it at like sometimes even at like parties and things, not like, so it kind of is, it's very more similar kind of in that way to the Epstein kind of stuff, where in their minds, I think too, especially, I mean, like, I think there is kind of that kind of comparison where it's kind of like a carnival-esque thing, you know?
Yeah, like, but isn't this like, can't you make this exact argument about like anti-Semitic, like, yeah. What do you think about Hitler's, eternal Jew thesis based on the fact that a lot of these guys are Jewish? Like,
yeah, the core of it springs from cultural wars within the church. Like, they kind of, this kind of overarching belief that Jesuits and different like groups within the church are pushing gay agenda to try to justify their own immorality or whatever, you know, like to kind of put themselves in good positions to kind of control us. And it actually connects. It's kind of funny because it's funny in a sick way, but like in Twitter kind of terms, it gets turned into, they call it priests with guitars. So it's like this idea that in the 60s, especially, like, there was this pivot to really trying to reach out to communities through popular music and just kind of, you know, using English instead of Latin and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of these people that are like right wing kind of critics of this stuff, anyways, they really get deep into this kind of culture stuff where they think that it was all this diversion created by liberals that wanted to ruin the church. So any of the people that kind of are at the top of the church that are more liberal minded, they're kind of seen as sometimes roped into this kind of conspiracy. There's actually, I mean, it's gotten to the point now where there's a, I think it's an HBO movie coming out called The Two Popes. And it's about, and it's got like Anthony Hopkins, I think is one of them. It's anyways, it's about Francis and Ratzinger. I mean, sorry, Francis and Benedict, or analogs that are fighting out basically two visions of the church in these kind of debates in this kind of like sensationalized movie. And it's become a really big topic. Anyways, it's really, there is this very, very common belief that like, it's all a giant struggle in the church. I feel like it's much more mundane. I think like Elizabeth Brunig has made a good point that the church is actually very poorly set up for, like it has a hierarchy, but the hierarchy is not really that effective. Like it doesn't, it can't really make the orders that it thinks it does kind of thing. It can't really enforce them. It thinks that it is, but it's not really doing it. And, you know, whenever that is the case, you kind of want to say, well, that someone's is at fault for that. But
I think that's often the case with like hierarchical yeah. organizations. Yeah. Like people sort of talk about like the CIA is some kind of like it makes decisions at the top. And then it just, those things happen in the world, just like it's Zeus throwing lightning bolts down. You know yeah. what I mean? Like that's not really yeah. how anything works. It's like, yeah. have you ever worked at a job? Like what the boss wants doesn't really happen just because yeah. he says so.
Yeah. And so I think that that's in this kind of thing, like there is a Marxist equivalent, obviously, like of thinking that it's all because of, like, because, you know, like in some socialist countries, you know, there was this idea that there was gay conspiracies and things like that too. Right. So I don't know. Like, I think that's, The question itself seems like a joke to me. Like it just, you know, I mean, it seems like a kind of half joking kind of silliness thing. But like, I think that that kind of underlying thesis needs to be rejected pretty quickly because it leads to kind of not helpful sidetracks kind of thing. Yeah. So
I think maybe a more plausible kind of connection. I mean, we talked before, you know, the prevalence of, you know, mostly secular kind of Zionist Jews in this particular ring, the Epstein ring, seems to be a function of, you know, the historical contingency. The Italian mob was sent back to Italy. The Jewish mob was retained as kind of the CIA interface to the underworld, right? In the same way, I mean, the most plausible kinds of explanations for the homosexual component of this seem to be more like local contingency. And I think it's much more plausible to me that the associations of homosexuality with fascism and the importation of, you know, a significant number of German ex-Nazis and people who are involved with that scene into the US has more to do with that. But I don't know.
As far as this guy's question, or girl, I guess, their question goes about, can a Marxist critique be used to help frame this for the left, such that you don't need fake news to elevate class consciousness? Well, I definitely agree that you shouldn't be using fake news to elevate class consciousness. And I honestly don't really like the whole concept of class consciousness very much. I think that tends to be just a way of measuring how like ideologically like loyal people are to your particular doctrine generally. But the idea of a Marxist critique helping to frame things, it can be, it's useful to an extent, I think, because you can look at this in a way as the upper classes protecting themselves and fighting within themselves to maintain control over things, and that really doesn't have anything to do with us. We're kind of just cattle. So I think that's effective for what that is. But as far as like parsing the minutiae, I don't know really what you would be using Marxism for exactly. You can kind of look at different historical scenarios and maybe that will help you make sense of that. But I don't think it's like the be all end all. I think you kind of actually do need to follow up on individuals and trace how that sort of stuff works. And it's not just going to boil down to some kind of class war thing. So let's move on to the next one. Will Epstein brain, the mental condition, ever be included in the DSM? No, I don't think so. I think whoever controls the networks also control the DSM. So
Yeah. That's my favorite question though of the lot. I like yeah. Epstein brain. I like that as a, you know, the thing that made me think of was that photo of Epstein at the school, right? At the school that Barr's father hired him at.
Right,
and
right.
He's standing in front of the blackboard with like a couple of crudely scrawled mathematical equations because he's ostensibly a math teacher. And it, next to it, it has his name written on the board and it's misspelled, right?
Yeah.
It's like E-P-S-T-I-N-E. And, you know, and this guy went immediately into a Bear Stearns like trading position, or, you know, high international finance, a guy who couldn't spell his name. So Epstein brain is something, man. I don't know what it is, but it's something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that's some kind of like joke or something that he spelt it that way
maybe
for some
is,
reason
yeah.
or whatever, but it did sort of like, it does kind of drive me a little crazy, like trying to figure out like why is his own name spelled wrong at a time and place where he had no reason to do that? Like, what is that about?
He's a school teacher. Oh man, I don't know. Yeah, it's something else. But I think that yeah, the answer is no. The psychiatrists are part of the problem, right? And the DSM is concocted by people who probably, you know, that population is probably enriched in Epstein brain. I mean. Psychiatrists are interesting people.
Okay, let's keep moving here. What is up with people finding it hard to imagine that the CIA helped put Epstein in his position and people in the or with connections to the government then murking him? CIA selling weapons to guerrillas for cocaine and creating the crack epidemic is common knowledge. Pedophile honeypot island shouldn't be harder to believe than actually creating chaos in the country that they claim to protect. Do you think people are too scared of being viewed as Pizzagaters or Trumpist deep state chuds to admit to themselves that the U.S. government might actually be evil? Anyways, thanks for a cool show. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to my mom and dad. They don't listen to the show, but I think it's important to do nice things for your family, even if they don't notice it. Peace. Yes,
right.
I agree with you about the thing with your family. You're probably right that there are people who are afraid of being viewed as like Pizzagaters, conspiracy theorists, yada, yada. But I don't know. I think a lot of people are willing to buy the idea that the CIA and Epstein have like an intimate relationship of some kind. It doesn't seem to be out of the question. Maybe this was asked maybe a month ago or something, and it seemed like there were more people putting up resistance. But I don't know. Seems like it's not totally mainstream, but it's definitely not like it on the fringes anymore.
Yeah.
I feel like our definition of mainstream might be different from other people's, though, because it's not like, you know, I mean, even if they do talk about it sort of on the news a bit, but like, I don't know. It's not like it's not like they debate it on the Democratic primary or something and actually get into it or something, right?
Like, I suppose, like, but I'm just talking about like
sure.
regular folks that I talk to who online. And there was like some poll that was done that like 68% of Americans think that he was killed and that it wasn't.
Oh, really? Wow.
I mean, I'm sure like 50% of that group think that it was the Clintons or something, but
sure. I think sometimes when people say everyone, they mean do ruling class liberals also have an agreement with this or something. You know what I mean? Like
that's
I think
true.
That's
yeah.
I think that's some of it. I mean, I find that with the DSA kind of stuff now because people are talking about how it's not like a dirty word to say socialism anymore and stuff. And I think that's true with like some people, especially like youth culture. But I feel like if you asked a lot of Americans before, I don't think that they would have been like, I don't know. I think that's kind of more, I can say it in front of my parents now kind of thing. Not like actual, like if you asked, I always think like, you know, people say about, I don't know, like they're saying this many socialists and stuff. And I said, if you asked people in prison, and there's like a million people in prison or something like that, you asked a lot of them, like, do you support capitalism or something, right? Like, and people, but those kind of people are just not thought of as political in that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many people in the United States where just millions and millions of people who are just totally against the system in any way, and they're not part of a socialist organization that, you know, so people think that they're not political in the same way or something, right? So I don't know. Yeah, that kind of is like a grievance of mine. Yeah,
I agree. There is something I want to mention since it kind of came up in this question, the terminology of pedophile island. So that term and also the name for the plane being Lolita Express all come from the same source. And that source is, I can't remember her name. It's Chernovsky or something like that. She published a book about Epstein a little bit before this whole thing blew up, and she's kind of, she kind of framed it as like a pro-Trump sort of narrative, like that Trump was going to drain the swamp and get rid of all these pedophile Clinton types, you know what I mean? And that's where these terms come from, is from that particular lady. And she is apparently deeply tied to Israeli intelligence pro-Zionist folks. Like her literary agent is ex-Mossad, apparently.
Yeah.
So I'm of the opinion that the focus on the island is some kind of diversion, and it seems to be coming from the Zionist camp of things. And I'm not sure what the purpose of that is exactly, but there seems to be a lot of people seem to want to act like it all happened on the plane and the island, and it was just some kind of like thing there, and not really going into the New Mexico ranch, the Florida residences, mm-hmm. Paris, and everywhere else where this might have been going on. I mean, maybe it's just to protect certain people or something. That seems to be falling apart a little bit nowadays. Like New Mexico is becoming more and more in the news, and people are mentioning that like there's a lot of people who've gone to that ranch and not come out and all this kind of stuff. So I don't know. We'll just have to see what happens with that. That's one of the things, of the very few things these days that seems to be developing and kind of interesting. I think the case is largely run cold, and we're not going to get a lot of new information out about it. But the New Mexico, maybe we'll see something. I mean, the governor of New Mexico is probably deeply implicated in all of this stuff, so they're probably doing everything they can to squash this, but we'll see, you know.
I was just going to say, I think you might be right about the little St. James thing being a distraction. I mean, there was briefly kind of mention of, well, like, he also has Greater St. James, which is a much more significant island to the northwest. And then, like, all of this attention was placed on the, like, quote-unquote temple, right? Which is this kind probably of, like, arabesque. Really. What's that?
I was just going to say, it's probably nothing, that temple. Yeah. It might not even be a temple. It might just
be... It's some outbuilding. It was built like a couple of years ago, and there's probably nothing significant about it. Did weird, you know, creepy sex happen there? Maybe, but that's not the central kind of like interesting feature of even that island. And that's only one of the islands. So,
yeah. I mean, I guess the focusing on the island has successfully, it seems, distracted from the Wexner house in New York. Yeah. People have, that's kind of like faded a little bit, I think, from popular imagination. And the other thing is, like, none of the people, the women who have come forward, have mentioned the island. They've mentioned being on the plane sometime, but mainly like the abuses and stuff. I haven't seen any stories that have been like, we were on the island and this happened or anything like that.
There's one. I know of one that came out in that big document dump. There was there were a couple of Hispanic kind of like kitchen staff who were working for the Dubans, or Dubin. I don't know how to say the name, but they're very wealthy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are like wealthy New York types that were connected with Epstein, and basically these kitchen staff left their service because. I think it was Maxwell or one of the other women that Epstein was associated with came into the kitchen with this like sobbing girl or whatever. And they had a conversation with her in which she alleged that I believe she was abused on the island. They took her to the island, took her passport away, and then started demanding sex from her.
Yeah. I mean, I don't doubt that stuff happened on the island. Yeah. I'm just saying that it seems like they are wanting us to focus on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's probably a reason not to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Okay. A global pedophile conspiracy requires active management from the highest levels of financial and political power. And that's why this thing had such a messy ending, because Trump can't or won't wrap his head around something so complicated. Everything you've been told your entire life is a lie. Whoops. Forgot to tell a joke. Yeah, I mean, I think that this has been messy to an extent and has also been intentional and managed to an extent. I have been kind of toying with the idea that, you know, people have been talking about there seems to have been no dead man switch when Epstein was was taken down, you know, arrested or anything, we might be witnessing the dead man switch in effect right now with people like, and Epstein might have been kind of knowingly or not the first guy on that list of people who was going to go down. Like it might have been set up that way so that like if and when he got caught, he would have been removed too. And that would, I don't know. There, it just seems to me like a little bit too easy for this to just, oops, big mistake. And then, because all that had to happen was people come forward with the stories. That was the only thing that had to happen for all this whole thing to come unraveled. It's possible, but I feel like they probably took that into account and had some kind of defenses and plan Bs and stuff planned for that kind of thing. So I feel like there's been a crisis that they're trying to manage, and what they're trying to do, and by they I mean the various factional power brokers in the world, are trying to position themselves so that they can come out ahead of other people and kind of throw their rivals or whoever they need to under the bus. So one person that I look to as an example of that is Ehud Barak. Previously, it seemed to be covered up as being implicated in the Epstein thing by the New York Post. When they had published pictures of Epstein and some of the models that were going to his place, they mentioned an unidentified man. And recently they have come out and identified him as Ehud Barak, and they published pictures of him that they didn't previously. And it's very clearly Ehud Barak. There was no reason for them to call him an unidentified man unless there was a reason to. And so you might ask, why would they be doing this to Ehud Barak? Well, there's the Israeli elections where Netanyahu and Barak are at odds. So I think if we go back to the whole mega group thesis that Whitney Webb put forth, Netanyahu is tied up with Lauder and a bunch of members of that group. So it might be that Netanyahu is the more favored candidate here, and so they're willing to throw Ehud Barak under the bus with this whole Epstein scandal if it means that they get their guy to win an election in Israel or something. So just an example theory. I'm not even necessarily saying that I know this for a fact or something, but that just is kind of one possibility that would make sense to me.
I don't really buy this, like, you know, Trump's an idiot and mishandled it.
I agree. I think he plays, I mean, it's not like playing dumb exactly, but I think he has a lot of things going on in the background that you put up some kind of cover, and you just have to act like some kind of way that doesn't give away all the stuff you're doing, that it looks stupid if you just take it for granted. But people talk about the Clintons being criminals and stuff. I mean, Trump is also the same way, you know. It's just that they have a different way of managing the PR of that kind of behavior, I think.
Well, like, what is going to happen to him? Why is he stupid? How has he failed? Like, isn't he in a good political position to go into 2020? I mean, it seems like it. Like, he has this Epstein stuff now kind of contained and massaged as a, you know, like, Clinton narrative. He's got the QAnon thing. Like, I don't know. It seems like he's doing pretty well, like, as far as his own personal interests go.
Yeah, I agree. What's really interesting as far as Trump goes is the whole thing with Bannon. So Bannon was originally in his administration, kind of like his right-hand man. People were talking about Bannon being like the Dick Cheney-like genius behind Trump and all that. And then he got kicked out. And now apparently Bannon was the source for a lot of the stuff in that book, Fire and Fury, or whatever. That was the big anti-Trump book that, you know, you guys remember this book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bannon apparently was really tight with Epstein. Bannon also had this weird place where he was producing meth, and there was all kinds of pornography and stuff being filmed
right there.
And I now he has this thing in Italy, which is like a gladiator school. Like,
what?
Have you not heard of this? He has some
gladiator.
Yeah, it's like a, it's sort of like, my impression is that it's like one of these like elite alpha male mindset academies for like rich folks. But I also suspect that it's some kind of like creepy Roy Cohn honeypot type thing too. You know? So who knows what's going on there? It's very interesting. I'm sure we'll get some more developments as that goes on, but
yeah,
you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background, I think, with all this stuff. So to look at any one of these guys as stupid is probably, they would love to have you just think that, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, next question is, if it turns out Pizzagate is real, do we have an obligation to rise up or something? Well, I mean...
Against what?
Yeah, against what and to what effect? Like, I don't think anyone ever has an obligation to do something if it just means they're immediately going to be shot. Like, that, you know, that's not a good move. You want to make sure that if you do anything, it's actually going to be to some effect. Which is a sunnah, isn't it? That's part of the fiqh of that.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be reasonable about this. And, I mean, I've thought about this from the... like a sort of a layperson Shari perspective. Like, what is the obligation of someone? If you become aware, like, not merely that the Sultan or Emir is, you know, like a kafir and he's like, you know, spending all his time with dancing girls and stuff like this, but like all that it's, you know, he's abducting the children of the people and he's like an openly evil guy. Like, what is your obligation? And then extend that out into, okay, well, it's not just one guy, right? It's this huge network that's interpenetrating institutions and intelligence agencies and all this stuff. It becomes a very difficult question, like, what is my responsibility? And I think until you can answer that, you know, there's no point in talking about rising up.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of well, not reading a lot of Pynchon, but I've been getting back into Pynchon, specifically Gravity's Rainbow, and reading some of the critical stuff that people have written about his works and whatnot. And one of the things that people seem to bring up is that, you know, he paints a very bleak picture about the prospects of, you know, liberating people from the kind of like evils of control and oppression and stuff in the world. But that the one hopeful possibility that we have in the world is like family. That he seems to kind of use the idea of like having a good family life and like passing on good morals and values to your children and kind of like just developing that so that people can have some kind of decency in their lives. I mean, it's kind of, maybe that's easy and trite or something. I can see people arguing it that way, but I don't know. That makes sense to me. I don't even know if there's like a real alternative to that kind of thing. And family doesn't necessarily need to mean like nuclear family and biological family, just be community and that kind of thing, just like being decent to one another in, you know, the people most immediate to you, because at a certain point the world is just going to be this way. It's not, you know, we're not going to make everything okay, you know what I mean? So at a certain point you have to kind of just accept that that's what the world is like, and you kind of need to find a way to live happily regardless.
I don't think it is trite and easy. You know, I think like forming a stable family that can have kids that are A, protected from this system, and B, you know, protected from developing into the kind of person who wants to participate in this system for whatever reason, that's really hard. Sure. And, yeah. You know, I think that's if you can do that, if you make that your life task, then you've probably have fulfilled your moral obligations with regard to this, right? So I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, next question is, what are your thoughts on the Marc Dutroux case/cover-up in Belgium, and do you see any possible connection to Pizzagate or Epstein?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, thoughts on it? It was pretty bad. It's interesting that it became such a big deal to Belgians that they shut down the government and had like a nationwide strike, like more than a general strike. It was like everybody's striking. So that's very interesting. I don't see that happening in the US. I think we're too fractious and just scared of the authorities, maybe rightly so, to do anything like that. As far as like a direct connection to Epstein, I haven't found one exactly, but there is one to the CIA through Arpad Busson, I believe. He was involved in DynCorp and that whole thing in Bosnia with like organ trafficking and sex trafficking that happened there under the CIA's cover. And he apparently is tied to Dutroux. I forget the exact details on that, but if the CIA is involved with Epstein and the CIA is also involved with DynCorp, and Busan is involved with Dutroux. Well, there's a kind of second or third degree of separation there. So there's that. It's not direct, but it's something, I guess. I tend to think that you're kind of, it's almost like asking, like, is there a connection between like Coca-Cola and, I don't know, so like Fuyao, some Chinese automotive company? Not exactly, but yes, right? Because they kind of operate on the same level. Like, they're both major corporations. They probably have a lot of the same interests and whatnot. So it's probably the same thing with these criminal organizations and networks and conspiracies and stuff. They probably involve some of the same people at times, but they don't necessarily have to, and they might even come into conflict with each other. So
I think it's more like Coke and Pepsi, right? I mean, it's like they're kind
with of... With Dutroux and Epstein? Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, like and different target markets slightly, you know, like Dutroux clearly is more like it's, you know, teen girls, but he's doing really violent stuff and he's filming that and he's distributing the films and that's his primary activity. It's not, I don't think... direct blackmail very much at all. It's the production of snuff films. So
yeah, Dutroux seems a lot more similar to Franklin than to Epstein's kind of like high society kind of like Epstein in a way is like not as sordid as some of the other stuff that became visible in the 80s.
I think the stuff that we know about Epstein is like among the least of all of these crimes, you know, like it's not anywhere near as violent as you know, some of these things. Dutroux certainly. So.
All right. So the next question, I want to just answer this real quick because this could very easily go off on a crazy tangent. So as a follow-up to the previous question, someone said, or Israeli art students for that matter. So the Israeli art students, there's been many cases of Israeli espionage in the United States where Israel has been found spying on the U.S., either taking industrial secrets or security secrets or whatever. And in many instances, they've been, it's sort of been like forgiven and hand waved away and dismissed. And Israeli art students, oftentimes it appears the Israelis will use agents under the cover of being art students. So that's what that's in reference to. Is there a connection here? There's probably something in because there seems to be a connection between Epstein and Mossad, and the Israeli art students are obviously connected to Mossad. There's also some sort of thing going on with 9/11 and the art students. I don't remember exactly what that is, but I found recently, which a lot of this stuff has not really shaken my world too much, but this really kind of like made my mind explode. There's a connection between Epstein and 9/11. So Mohammed Atta was trained as a pilot by a German pilot. Can't remember his name right now. Boehringer or something like that. German guy. This pilot was also a personal pilot for a Russian oligarch, Viktor Kozenzi, I believe is his name. This man owns about a third of the Ukrainian economy and seemed to make a lot of his money on cocaine trafficking. And Kozenzi knew George Mitchell. George Mitchell, you know, the American politician. And now George Mitchell is tied up with a lot of the Epstein stuff. Right. So, you know, it's not a direct connection. I'm not saying like Epstein was one of the guys on the planes or whatever, but it's just bizarre the fact that there's sort of like this criminal network that people are willing to use for their own purposes and stuff, I think is the takeaway from that kind of stuff. It'll be interesting to see what develops with that. That was something that I found Daniel Hopsicker talking about. That's the only source I have on that too, but he also had like video footage of interviews he had done with these guys' girlfriends and stuff that were talking about this stuff. So it goes back to that first question we talked about with, you know, what if they're just lying? What if they're just trying to sell books? Yeah, it's very possible that it could be. I've also seen people talk about Hopsicker seeming to be some kind of like cop type of dude or something. Okay, maybe so. Maybe it's all bullshit.
If you believe that Dutroux was part of the sort of like EU NATO Gladio network, then there might also be a connection there because Atta was trained at Kemper Aviation, which employed as a chief pilot trainer this guy, Jean-François Bousselet. And he was one of the guys who was implicated in the Brabant killings from 82 to 85, which was like 30 people killed, probably by CIA Gladio types at that time. So that may be all sort of linked in as well. Although, you know, like this question of connections to 9/11, I think that's just starting to get developed, right? So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been much of a 9/11 guy, but I'm willing to accept the idea of there being some sort of connection to a criminal network that involved terrorism. Like, that doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to the next question here. So this cabal is essentially omnipresent in business and intelligent at the commanding heights of the Imperial World Order. Do they share that power with anyone? What is the relationship between the elite blackmail societies and the military? What other organizations are on their level of influence? Well, this is sort of really asking like a real zoomed out big picture kind of a question. Like, what is the structure of power look like in the world? That's actually really what my interest in looking at any of this stuff is to try to suss that out a little bit and just figure it out. I would say that there are factions in this country and in the world, and Epstein in particular seems to be closely tied to what you could call, for lack of a better term, the Zionist faction. And that faction seems to primarily be located in the United States and Israel, but also in Russia, in the UK, and elsewhere in the world. There's other factions that seem to exist in the U.S. I would say that there's this Zionist faction. There's the so-called Eastern Establishment, which is sort of like your liberal George Soros type thing with the Clintons and the CIA broadly. And then there's sort of like a far right or a right wing establishment as well. Those are the ones that really creep me out. They're the people like the World Anti-Communist League, Le Cercle, Gladio. A lot of those Gladio type stuff are tied up with them. Propaganda Dua in Italy. Some of the creepy Catholic groups like the Order of St. John and the Knights of Malta and all this kind of stuff. Opus Dei, all that kind of stuff. So I think that there are various factions that are, you know, it's sort of like they're playing a game and they want to keep the game going. So they're going to defend each other as far as maintaining the game, but then they're going to also try to get one up on each other to eke out a little bit more power or control or whatever. So do they share that power with anyone? Maybe, if it means that it will allow them to kind of keep playing. But I think they would also at times find it that they want to rescind that sharing of the power. And the relationship between elite blackmail societies and the military, again, this is actually probably going to be its own episode at some point, because I've been looking into the origins of the national security apparatus and how that was formed. Because a lot of people don't, at least for myself, I never really thought about it too much, but you kind of just think of like, oh, and then the FBI was formed and just kind of like sprung out of the ground with all these guys in suits and sunglasses and earpieces and stuff. Yeah. But they had to get people from somewhere. They had to kind of form it out of something, and a lot of what these were far right organizations and militias and police forces that were wanting to go a little farther than they were allowed to do as police and all that kind of stuff. So that's very interesting to me, and I think if we follow our narrative going back to the 30s of the establishment of these blackmail societies, if you consider that that's where the OSS came from around the same time and that they were implicated in all of this, I think there's probably some connection there. At this point today, I don't know. Yeah, I just don't know enough about that to speak to it.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. I hope we do get into that in a future episode, yeah.
Yeah, I just need to put together some notes and stuff.
I had some memory triggered this question, actually, of a video which the questioner may be interested in looking at. There's an interview with a woman called Kay Griggs, G-R-I-G-G-S, that's available on YouTube. If you search Kay Griggs, Satanism in the Military. And that's the most extensive military testimony that I've seen with regard to something, which is clearly one of these blackmail rings. Although Griggs was interviewed by a I believe, an evangelical pastor, and this was in the 90s. So they're kind of interpreting it as like a Satanism, like homosexuality thing. Like it's like the gay priest thing that Don was talking about. It's okay. Like they think it's like a gay, I don't know, like gay dudes in the military who are organized into this sort of secret cabal. But she names a lot of names, and she's very specific about the kinds of things that they were doing. She claims that the Beirut bombing was a false flag, and she offers a whole bunch of details about the specific commanding officers that were involved in that. So I would suggest if it's I think like a 7-hour interview, but if the questioner is really interested in that, that seems to have some information that's useful.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So this is going to be our last question. We made it, guys. Have they used the NSA to blackmail any commoners yet? Oh, wait. Whoops. No, sorry. We got two more questions. So we'll do this one first. Have they used the NSA to blackmail any commoners yet? That's clearly what it's for, but if they've used it, we haven't found out about it yet.
Yeah, I think we do know about this, at least on the overt side in terms of parallel construction. There's lots of evidence that many of the prosecutions that have been happening in the U.S. have happened as a result of parallel construction from NSA surveillance. So if they can deal with little people administratively, they're not going to like blackmail you, right? They're not going to show up and say, hey, you know, we're going to ruin your life with this evidence. If they have evidence that they can pin a crime on you or something like that, they're just going to deal with you administratively, right? They're going to put you in prison and neutralize you that way.
Yeah, I think if you kind of trace the way this stuff has developed, it's gotten, they prefer to be hands off and to be like with a soft touch kind of do this stuff. So doing outright criminal like blackmail and like thuggish kind of stuff, that's like a last resort or something you do to someone who has the resources and ability to kind of wiggle out of other kinds of things to get over those kind of obstacles that they can put in front of us commoners, as the questioner says.
Yeah, I think if you can afford like expensive lawyers, that's when you go for the Epstein type blackmail, right? You need the Epstein type blackmail for those people. But if it's someone who can't afford to protect themselves in the legal system, then they're pretty vulnerable.
Right. Okay, and so actual last question here. Was the cabal shit going on in the Eastern Bloc before its collapse? Rival cabals? Different groups entirely with the same principles? Or, if you like, how much political influence did organized crime have in the Eastern Bloc? Yeah, this is, I don't have a lot of precise information about this, but it is something that interests me. I think the Russian mafia is pretty heavy on all this stuff. And the real linchpin that ties all of that together, Russian mob, Israeli intelligence and Western intelligence and all this kind of stuff, is Robert Maxwell. He worked for everybody at the same time, and that it seems like there's a very interesting blog post to read about this actually on the Vice blog, VISUP, and he has a blog post up there called Russian Games, and he talks about Robert Maxwell working with the Soviets and getting them to establish corporations and companies in the West under the, I mean, at least this is what they said, although I get the impression that they didn't really believe this themselves. They thought that if they established these businesses in the West, they could kind of corrupt capitalism and introduce communism into the West that way. And also that they saw that the Soviet Union was on its way out, and that this would be sort of like almost like the Nazi rat lines, like they could kind of run into these corporations and set up themselves there, then bring communism back to life later. But of course, what ended up happening instead was that this was one of the ways that opened up the Soviet economy to U.S. manipulation or Western manipulation and the privatization schemes that happened afterwards. A lot of those people got very rich off of that, and they were all kind of working together and backstabbing each other after that all happened. Do I think that this was going on in the Eastern Bloc? It really wouldn't surprise me if similar things were happening. I think the NKVD and the KGB and all that stuff, it wasn't beyond them to do any of this kind of stuff. But they also probably didn't need to do a lot of the same kind of things because they were operating with a different political system where you just needed to control certain government offices and whatnot, and you could just get it done through the official police instead of having to do this sort of like mafioso kind of thing. So I think it probably looked differently, but it, I would be, honestly, I would be surprised if it just didn't exist in the Eastern Bloc.
Yeah, they did have like an enormous criminal underground and stuff, right, that was pretty much meshed with the system. That's a lot of like tankies and stuff online. That's what they focus on, because they kind of think that the average person was very pro-socialism and then the criminal networks kind of took over. That's kind of like their narrative. And with connections with spies, I feel like the population was so cynical that I don't think that, it's not like they were cynical and dedicated socialists. They were cynical and didn't really see the big deal either way. They didn't really have any control over it. They might still even vote for left-wing communist parties just to say screw it or something, you know, to try to like get back at the people that are in charge now. But I don't feel like, especially in the rest of Eastern Europe, I don't think there's like a large core of people who are dedicated radical socialists. There's small groups that still support and generally tend to be people that didn't like the old system anyways. Trotskyists and stuff, I think there's a lot of those kind of things. But most of the people that were in the kind of more ruling party stuff just shifted over to social democratic coalitions or just liberal parties or whatever, you know, like they didn't. Yeah. So I don't think that like the true believer people didn't really, I don't know if they exist anymore. Yeah. So really.
There's definitely a sense in which this has become sort of a social phenomenon in places independently of you know, like the even this kind of like criminal cabal kind of idea, like a mafia thing. And the thing that this question made me think of was China, because the use of sex as kind of a business tool in China is pervasive, like completely pervasive. I kind of became peripherally aware of this a long time ago, but it's now kind of become more in the public imagination and it's better documented. There's a really good piece written by a guy called James Palmer, and it's called The Bro Code. And I would really recommend people who are interested in this stuff happening in other societies read that, because he talks about how this just happens as like kind of a business tool, right? It's something that like really low level people are engaging with. Like he quotes this guy who tells him, I want to do business. I take a guy from the government out. We have drinks. We go to somewhere good. We find girls. He thinks I'm a cool guy. I know he's a guy who likes girls. We're friends. Business, right? Like
that's so Trumpian, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It really is. You know, so, but that's, you can see how this can become like a mentality, right? Where it's just like, well, of course you go to the KTV club with the guy you're trying to do business with, and then both of you are filmed, you know, like having sex with one of the KTV girls. Your wives know about it, you know, et cetera. This is how you establish the goods on the other person so that you can have a productive relationship. It's very strange. But
you know, it's funny about that is that when I was in China, I actually, so at the university I was at, they had for the first year ever, it's like a sociology department was what I was sort of housed under. It was the first year that they ever had a class about sort of like LGBT issues and sexuality, right, and stuff. So I actually attended a lot of the lectures and things, and they were talking about this kind of stuff about like sex work in China and some of the different tropes and stuff about gay life in China and all that kind of stuff. Like that was kind of what they were talking about. And I was surprised, and it kind of, once they pointed it out, I kind of, you know, was more hip to it kind of thing. But they suggested that really prostitution is pretty open there. Like it's pretty, it's technically illegal, I think, but they said about like the different types of places that they tend to be like dual purpose things, kind of like here, yeah, where it's like massage.
Yeah.
But like barbers.
Yeah,
and things,
yeah,
like
there's
that,
a lot of barbers, kind of, yeah.
And they were saying about how it tended to be one of those things where there was kind of like this official way that you're supposed to not talk about, almost kind of like how marijuana was for years or something like that in the United States, where it was so pervasive but easy to access and stuff like that kind of thing, like that it didn't, it almost seemed absurd that it was illegal kind of thing. I think that was kind of the attitude. And once I heard those kind of stories, I started noticing that obviously that, you know, you would walk by a place and it would be, you know, like really late at night, and it would be a barbershop and it would be open, and it was just, you know, girls hanging out kind of looking half asleep, kind of just waiting for a customer or something like that kind of thing. You're like, oh man. So I don't know, it was a weird kind of a relationship, with just a personal experience of that, you know. So
yeah, I think it's something we can kind of get caught up in the specific details of what's past, you know, but when you see it happening as this kind of like pervasive social phenomenon that lots and lots and lots of people are participating in, and they don't really see anything wrong with it, it's sure. It's scary, right? It's difficult to know how you would deal with that, even just from the perspective of like, how do we ensure that the government is functioning in like a modestly non-corrupt manner if this is a social norm?
Right? Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
Sure.
Oh, there are two more questions. I'm sorry. These two snuck up on me. Okay. Is following or focusing on this case sinful or disordered? I can't help myself. The level of intrigue and scandal is unlike anything I've ever seen, but I worry about the indirect consumption of these women's living nightmares. Well, we sort of answered a similar question early on in the episode, but this person definitely seems like they're not taking it too well. So just based on the impression I'm getting here, I would say maybe you should take a break from it. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be there.
Yeah, that's the thing. It'll be here, and there's plenty to look into. Like, you don't, and it's not like you need to keep up with it. You know what I mean? Like, at this point, I think it's going to slow down to a trickle of information here and there, and it's not going to be like the way it's been, where it's like every day something in the news. I mean, I think we already see that happening. So, yeah, definitely, if you feel like a bad feeling in your gut or whatever, it's time to relax and, you know, explore the lighter side of life for a second. Next question is, what do you think might be happening within Epstein's larger intelligence, criminal, financial, etc. network that caused things like Pizzagate, QAnon, and Epstein's second imprisonment and murder to happen? In other words, what's going on behind the scenes? Well, I guess, like, again, that kind of, I explained a little bit of what I thought might be going on, is that there may have been some mistakes made that kind of blew things up, but it also seemed a little convenient that all it took was a few of the victims to come out with their stories after they had thought that they had shut them up. So maybe that's what happened, but maybe there's something else going on and that people are sort of using this for their own benefit somehow.
Why did he fly back to the States to get arrested? I mean, that part, like, clearly there's something going on there. His arrest was not a coincidence.
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe he was given the impression that he would be protected and it wasn't actually the case. And so, yeah, it sort of seems like he was set up a little bit or something, right?
Yeah. There's one thing that I came across just recently. I mean, broader network, but some of those pictures that were released of Epstein's dead face, and as well, I think the Maxwell photo from the In-N-Out Burger, those were distributed through the New York Post. There's a guy on Twitter who found like PGP, like email encryption keys embedded in those photos. So, you know, they're clearly like, they're doing something, they're up to something, they're communicating, you know, through these means. That In-N-Out photo burger was definitely a message of some kind, right? Like, I don't think anyone was in doubt about that, but, you know, in terms of what it is, who knows?
I think that I've seen the PGP stuff too. I think that's a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah. I'm not a crypto guy, so I have no idea.
Neither am I. So that's just like, doesn't make sense to me that this is how they communicate, by like getting pictures published in the New York Post. Why would that image file be the same one that they actually received as well? You know, like, they might have published an image and if they changed it at all, isn't that going to mess up the whole encryption stuff? Maybe. I mean, again, yeah. I don't know this kind of thing.
I guess the question is, because the Post is supposed to be kind of a cutout, right? So if someone in the Post is collaborating with her, then they could embed the key or something like that. But, you know, who knows?
It just seems to me like there's easier and more secure ways to communicate to people than using for us people that like to kind of use this as a kind of like entertainment, you know, like, oh yeah, it reminds me again of like the finding the Illuminati symbols in the music videos and stuff. It's like, what is the point of that exactly?
Yeah.
You know, why it's all very convenient that it's stuff that we have access to as like mass media. So yeah, I just tend to think that doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe it's the case, I don't know, but it doesn't. It, there's a lot of things pushing in the other direction for me on that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, so I guess that does it for the questions. We got through it. The last thing that I wanted to discuss before we end this was just kind of where we're going to go with this sort of stuff. I do want to continue doing these kinds of episodes and things like this. So the stuff that I've been researching lately, and I haven't really gotten enough together to do a full episode about any of this yet, but I've been looking at the establishment of banks and banking fronts by the CIA in the Caribbean, especially in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and even the 60s. That's been very interesting. I've been reading a lot of Peter Dale Scott and related sources on that. The other thing, as I mentioned before, was the origins of national security organizations. So the OSS and the FBI and even like OS, the original Army Operations Services or whatever it was called. That kind of stuff is very interesting to me because it involves a lot of very strange characters and American fascist ideologues and stuff like that. Like these people were all thinking together to kind of figure out what to do about the labor uprising and the fact that like people like FDR in the White House, which goes back to the business plot and all that kind of thing. And then the other thing that I've been looking at is the Russian and the British side of this stuff. So as far as pedophilia networks and things like that, the UK has a long and storied history of that kind of thing. And that's just a little bit too much for me to sink my teeth into at this point. But I am interested in looking at the way that MI6 and MI5 are kind of tied up with the other intelligence agencies. And as far as Russia goes, I'm interested in not just what was going on during the Soviet period, because that is kind of interesting to consider, but I'm more interested in trying to figure out the contours of what Russian organized crime looks like and how that works on a global level, because they seem to be, like the Russian mafia seems to be the actual power brokers in Russia more so than anything else. Like I think Putin has his own kind of clique, but they probably have mutual interests as well, so. Yeah, that's kind of where I'm looking at. Maybe we'll do individual episodes on each of those things. I'm not really sure. You guys should let us know what you're interested in hearing about and if any of those sound interesting to you. Do you have anything that you're looking into, Mike, that you want to mention here?
Yeah, just looking at some of those old Opperman Report episodes where he's going back and interviewing, you know, like key figures from some of these scandals in the past or people who know a lot about them and adding these little details in. And so that's been really fascinating. And I'm starting to piece together, especially this medical psychiatry stuff, a little bit more. Seeing particular guys show up over and over again. Martin Orne is one of them. But I've actually had to kind of pace myself, especially like just looking at that 9/11 stuff, because it's just so crazy, right? So
Yeah. It kind of gets back to the thing I said on the other episode where like you see two pieces of information, it seems to imply something, but you need to understand you don't have all the pieces. You just have two little scraps.
And
it could be that everything else points in the exact opposite direction. So it's got to be careful with that kind of stuff. I think it would be interesting to do something about MK Ultra and what's like a reasonable way to consider that kind of stuff. So I know you are a little bit more informed about that kind of stuff than I am. So maybe that could be your homework assignment and we'll figure that out at a certain point.
Yeah, sure.
And we'll just kind of touch base in a month or so, something like that. So,
yeah. And for me, I can only handle basically hearing from you guys what's going on. I can't dig into it myself, or I don't know. I'm already pretty prone to spinning out and might as well keep it, you know, within the bounds of this podcast. I think,
for me. Sounds like a good idea. I sort of like having you here as like an anchor, kind of keeps us from going off the deep end too far and being kind of like a little pillar of reality for us to bounce ideas off of.
Definitely.
I did. Yeah. I gave a few of my own spiels today, but
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for listening, guys. I hope you enjoyed this. It was really fun to kind of go through your questions and to see what kind of thoughts and stuff that, you know, our episodes on this thing has provoked. So yeah, keep sending in your feedback and your ideas and let us know what you're interested in hearing from us. Our Twitter, as usual, is at You Can't Win Pod, and you can hit us up on the Curious Cat there, or you can send them into the Discord if you are a Patreon subscriber. So we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
I stand alone against your mad, deadly, worldwide, conspiratorial, gangster, computer god communism with wall-to-wall, deadly gangster protection, lifelong sworn conspirators, murder, incorporated organized crime, the police and judges, the deadly, sneak-parroting puppet gangsters using all the gangster deadly Frankenstein controls, these hangman rope sneak deadly gangsters, the judges and the police trick, trap, rob, wreck, butcher, and murder the people that keep them terrorized in gangster Frankenstein earphone radio slavery for the communist gangster government and con artist parroting puppet gangster playboy scum on top. No escape from this worse gangster police state using all of the deadly gangster Frankenstein controls. Projection of deadly touch tarantula spiders. Worldwide living death. Worldwide living death. Worldwide living death. Worldwide.